We go to Deutsche Welle in Bonn today. We do it every Thursday, crossing over to Germany now. Our colleagues out at Deutsche Welle looking at the stuff important to the world and to Europe, I guess. And there's one such thing that the whole wide world is focusing on at this moment in time. We have Sid and Sanderson from our partners in Bonn on the line to share the latest development in Europe. Sid, welcome. What's the latest?
Hi there, Clarence. Well, as you mentioned, this week threw quite a bit of a curveball from the start with the news of the earthquake in Turkey. It made headline news on Monday morning, and that's really what we've all mainly been talking about here. So initially, the severity of the quake was not entirely clear, though it was close to 8 on the Richter scale, which is pretty severe. But the numbers of the victims just started multiplying and pouring quite fast. And that's when we began to realize that this might just turn into the natural disaster of the year. So from a few hundred initial victims on Monday morning only, we've now moved to over 16,000 casualties in total in Turkey and in neighboring Syria together. And that number, unfortunately, just keeps on growing fast. Meanwhile, there's hardly any hope left of finding anyone alive under all that rubble.
You mentioned Turkey, but also Syria. What's the situation like there, Sutton?
So the majority of the deaths are indeed recorded in Turkey, where the epicenter of the earthquake actually was. But there are also about 3,000 victims recorded in Syria so far, which literally is just located about 100 kilometers south from that epicenter of the quake. Now, the issue in Syria is the fact that this is still a country in a state of war. In fact, this is a major issue in that border region in particular. War will typically result in displacement of people, and displacement typically leads to migration movements. And this border area between Turkey and Syria has been a major hotspot for migration for over a decade now. So there are a lot of people in this region from Syria who perhaps, well, they're not native to this very area, but in recent days and weeks, they have made their way there in hopes of crossing the border into Turkey to get to safety, and then this happened. They were surprised just as much by this earthquake by the earthquake as the locals. But unlike the locals, they have little to no resources at hand to fend for themselves. So the narrative of this whole tragedy just keeps getting worse and worse the more you look into it, and the more you find out about the people who are most affected by it.
It sounds absolutely terrible, a war zone. What are the governments of Turkey and Syria doing to help?
Well, it's all turning into a bit of a mess, unfortunately. I suggest we remain with Syria first and talk about that. So, like I said earlier, Syria's been in a state of war, civil war, for well over a decade now. And the international community, led by the UN, has taken a position against the government. Quite rightly so, if you ask me, imposing sanctions and boycotts on Syria in order to weaken the stranglehold of Bashar al-Assad's regime on its own people. However, this also means that those very sanctions, some of which were imposed all the way back in 2011 against Assad, are now harming those in Syria who are most affected by this earthquake. Because sanctions are usually met with counter-sanctions, and Syria has not held back in sealing itself off from the international community in response to its reaction to the civil war. Now, let's listen to Khaled Hububati, president of the Syrian Arab Red Crescent, to get an idea of what the people there need in order to even begin to deal with the massive destruction caused by this natural disaster.
We need heavy equipment, ambulances and firefighting vehicles. We don't have heavy machinery to conduct rescue operations. There are a lot of issues due to sanctions against the Syrian people.
So there you have it. According to Hububati, there are these sanctions against Syria, which currently are holding back this whole recovery process. He even called it sanctions against the Syrian people. However, these very sanctions cannot just simply be bypassed unless they are officially lifted, which we know is not simply going to happen. The world is not going to backtrack on its condemnation on Assad because of this natural disaster. And also, the Syrian regime has indeed stolen money intended for aid before, which was most recently documented during COVID-19. So the UN can decide to create emergency corridors to bring in humanitarian aid in this extraordinary situation as an exceptional measure in exceptional times, if you like. However, this, although this has actually been done in Syria in the past, whenever there was need for humanitarian aid amidst the war, only in opposition-held areas did this ever happen, which the Syrian government clearly doesn't have any control over. So right now, the government does control close to three-quarters of the territory now, and it staunchly disagrees with the idea of making any special arrangements with the UN or anyone else. The regime basically is saying, you either lift the sanctions against us or we will not allow you to come in and provide aid. So Syria's ambassador to the UN, Bassam Sabah, told reporters just yesterday that the idea of moving aid into Syria across the country's borders was simply not on. Let's have a listen.
Without the control of the government, without permission of the government, without approval from the government, this is violation. Very simple.
There you have it. He says it's very simple. The Syrian government is basically equating the delivery of aid to a violation of its sovereignty. It is trying to hold the current situation, the misery and suffering of people, hostage as leverage on the global political stage. And according to UN figures from this week, it means that as many as 4 million Syrians in total might suffer because of this.
That's some serious stuff there, and I'm sure you'll keep following that story. But what about Turkey? What's the situation like there?
Well, I'd like to say that Turkey is used to earthquakes because there are three tectonic plates which cause major trouble in some shape or form, roughly once every decade. But that statement simply wouldn't be true. There is just no preparing for a tragedy like this. The same is true for past earthquakes in Turkey. You can't predict earthquakes or prepare enough. Now, the last major earthquake in Turkey claimed more than 17,000 lives back in 1999. This one, I think, will exceed that tally very soon, possibly within this day. The sad part right now in Turkey is, just like in Syria, politicians seem to want to abuse such natural disasters for their personal gain.
I'm not sure I understand what that's supposed to mean.
Well, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, he was quick to react to the tragedy, let's give him that. And in order to get a grip on the situation, he declared a state of emergency in the 10 regions most affected by the earthquake, lasting for the next 3 months. Let's first have a listen to Erdogan's announcement of that emergency.
In order to ensure that search and rescue operations and the works in the aftermath are carried out quickly, we've decided to declare a state of emergency based on Article 119 of the Constitution. We will complete the processes rapidly in the presidency and parliament with regard to this decision taken for the 10 cities that suffered from the earthquake, and it will last for 3 months.
So 3 months, that takes us well into May. A state of emergency in Turkey under that paragraph 119 doesn't just mean, you know, what you would expect, like an overnight curfew and a ban on massive demonstrations. In Turkey, it usually means the full scope of martial law in a very autocratic manner. Basically, Erdogan can now bypass parliament and the constitution to issue decrees in that region, which is affected by the earthquake. Now, at first, this may not sound too egregious considering the gargantuan task of the recovery process, right? But, and this is a very big but, the area affected by the earthquake roughly corresponds with the highest Kurdish population in Turkey.
Ah.
And yeah, this is where it gets interesting. For nearly 40 years, there's been a war against the Kurdish independence movement in Turkey. Tens of thousands of people have been killed as part of that strife. Now, Erdogan's treatment of Kurdish dissidents has been heavy-handed at the best of times. And I, for one, would not be in the least surprised if, in this state of emergency, he would use his extraordinary powers to address a few outstanding issues with regard to the whole Kurdish issue, because this is how the Turkish president time and again has shown he likes to do business.
Noted loud and clear. But what about the elections in Turkey in spring? Are they going to be affected in any way by this earthquake?
Well, that's the interesting question here. 3 months, like I said, we're going to have that state of emergency that takes us into May, and 5 days later, the elections are scheduled to take place on May 14th. And as far as we know, there's no announcement to the contrary that they would be postponed for any date or any reason. Now, if you're a struggling leader like Erdogan, who is poised to lose at the polls, a natural disaster like this is just one of those perfect opportunities to appeal to the populace and somehow secure more votes. Politicians who lead their people through a crisis tend to have far better chances at the ballot box. So we're going to have to see in 3 months' time whether this is also true for Mr. Erdogan.
Exciting development there. Thank you very much for sharing these insights with us. Certain Sanderson from our partners, Deutsche Welle out in Bonn. And